Hello and welcome to the BizTimes MKE podcast. I'm Andrew Weiland, the editor of BizTimes Milwaukee. This edition of the podcast is a follow-up to our 20th annual Commercial Real Estate and Development Conference. I'm joined by Jeffrey Castleman, Senior Vice President and Partner for Workplace Strategy with St. Louis-based commercial real estate development and investment firm CRG. Jeff works out of CRG's Chicago office, overseeing national accounts and leads all client-related initiatives for the company's expanding industrial office and data center project delivery platform. He also provides clients with strategy for the future of their workplace and technology in real estate. Jeff was the keynote speaker at our Commercial Real Estate Conference. Welcome to the podcast, Jeff.
Thank you, Andrew. I appreciate it, and thanks to BizTimes for having me.
Absolutely. Now, is it fair to call you a futurist?
I don't love it, to be honest. It's awkward, but when people hire you to speak and they want some sort of a hook to put the butts in the seats, it tends to be that, and it's kind of stuck. So I laugh when I call myself that or somebody calls me that, but it's sticking apparently, so.
Well, certainly at our conference this morning, you talked a lot about the future and gave us an awful lot to think about. And the purpose of this podcast is to sort of go through the questions that our audience asked you in response to your remarks. But I want to start off trying to quickly summarize what you were talking about. And there's an awful lot, so it's going to be hard to summarize. But I think the quickest takeaway might simply be the world is changing at an extremely rapid pace and faster than we think, right?
Correct. And it's driven by math, right? It's driven by that Moore's law of computing power doubling every 18 to 24 months, 30 iterations, soon to be 31, soon to be 32. Even if it slows down, the math that drives it is irrefutable. So again, I feel more like the messenger, letting people know this is important enough to take a moment and be aware of, and to start to think about, you know, what your strategy and your battle plan might be moving forward as a result.
And I know you started talking about some of the current kind of economic landscape, but then you got into, you know, some fairly significant high-tech issues. You talked about blockchain. You talked about artificial intelligence. Crypto's in the news, of course, with the FTX collapse. But you assured us that blockchain is not going to go away, and it's going to be a very significant. And I struggle mightily to understand it. But you feel it's going to be a tremendous presence in our world and our economy.
I do. It's hard to predict with accuracy the timeline. Bill Gates said we tend to overestimate, you know, what happens in 2 years' time and underestimate what happens in 10 years' time. And blockchain's in between those two and 10, right? So that's the safest prediction I could give to you. More importantly, though, as business drivers, it's more secure than the way we do things now. It's decentralized, so we don't have to pay a central authority figure to manage it for us and trust that they are doing it better than the stakeholders themselves might do it. It creates a record of permanence. So now you can travel with it, change stakeholders, change teams, no problem. It's your data. You own it. It goes back to the commentary I was making about this immense quantity of data that's being manufactured every single day by every single one of us, and we're giving it away for free. But if we could just harness some of it and monetize it, it's worth more than oil, it's worth more than gold, it's worth more than the money in your pocket. So blockchain is the enabler for that. That's the killer app.
And you also talked about artificial intelligence and the tremendous impact that's going to have. Can you just quickly touch on that a little bit?
Here's an analogy that may help listeners on this one. 100 years ago, we harnessed wired electricity. It wasn't a thing much earlier than that, roughly speaking. Mm-hmm. And we started saying, I wonder if we put that into a telephone, what would happen? Hey, I wonder if I put that into a light bulb, what would happen? Hey, if I put that into a washing machine, what would happen? And we have modern appliances and right. Think of AI now as that stimulus, and now it's applied to everything, everywhere. The difference is that AI is exponential in its growth trajectory. It can be networked with other AI computers anywhere in the world. It will work 24/7, 365. Never has a bad day, never doesn't go through a divorce, doesn't need a mental health break, right? Not taking a vacation to the Grand Caymans. It's working all the time. And so it may not seem like much at first, but in 2, 3, 5, 10 years, it will make immense, immense changes in everything and every company and every government and everything that we do.
So then,
it's an overlay technology.
Yeah. So when you think about these drastic technological changes that you talked about this morning, what's the implications for that in the commercial real estate industry?
It's a great question. It's really about that convergence that I talked about today. That's where I decided to focus on that point and not any one technology. When all these things have converged to become the mainstream way of conducting business, and we really can't remember what it used to be like without it, and that day's coming soon, it manifests itself in real estate in any number of ways. The repetitive, sometimes dangerous type jobs on a construction site or maybe even back at the office will have been automated. Okay, it will free up the real estate worker to be a knowledge worker, right? To work on relationships and strategy and bigger thinking. I don't think those are things that will be automated or roboticized anytime soon. So I'm not a gloom and doom at all on this, just so that people know that.
That's good.
I especially if you're willing, like I said, to upskill, to learn something new. Mm-hmm. Just learn how to code Python, right? Because Python is what drives, that's the code that drives AI. If you did nothing else, just take a Python class on a Saturday or a Sunday for a few months, right? That's all you really need to do. Suppose you partner with somebody. I don't mean to go off on this tangent, but this is really important. If you partner with a coder and you say, hey, I want to write an algorithm to do this, or I want to write an algorithm to do this, and I want it to be self-learning so that I can tell the world that I've adopted this AI tool to make their life better and our world better, and they do that programming, how do you know what they programmed if you yourself can read or write their code? Mm-hmm. Did they leave a back door? Did they leave a trap door? Did they put a Trojan horse in there? Are you sure you trusted them? I'm sure you vetted them. I'm sure they come highly recommended. And 99% of those partners will be good partners. So again, not a gloom and doomer. But if you don't know, how do you know what you don't know? And so I think that's a really safe, low-hanging place for people to engage. But back to your real estate question, I think you're going to see autonomous equipment. I think you're going to see shorter construction cycles. I think you're going to see more safety, more cost management. As a result of that, I think you're going to see more VTOL as an amenity, right? Being able to hop and skip, say, from Milwaukee to Chicago.
VTOL is what?
Vertical takeoff and landing.
Okay.
And if you do it in an EV, an electric vehicle, it's quiet. It doesn't bother the neighbors. There's no rotor noise or wind, right? It's, oh, that just took off. Right? And it came straight down. You don't need a big space for that. You just need the top of a building or what used to be a parking lot that isn't being used as a parking lot anymore. Perfect adaptability for that. And lastly, I think you'll see microgrids. I think you'll see power being generated where it's being consumed because of the shortage of power that we're just in the early stages of beginning to understand. So those are some of the ways that this technology manifests itself in real estate. And by the way, if you don't have these things, then your property value is going to be less than those that have them. And those that vote with their cash flow, with their leases, whether it's residential or office space, or somebody like me comes to town for one night and needs a place to stay for one night, we're going to vote with our dollars, aren't we? And so if you don't transition and don't adopt some of this, you do run the risk of being obsoleted much faster than you thought possible.
Yeah. And you talked about energy being a key issue going forward. You said next year we're going to see a lot of a lot of shakeups of energy.
It's really spot shortages of large quantities of power, hyperscale grade power, 100 megawatts. Okay, something like that takes a state to provision through the regulatory process 18 to 24 months, which follows a fairly lengthy engineering and feasibility process. And then there's the construction process once it's been approved. And so if you add all that together, you're really looking at least 3, if not 4 years, which means if you're a data center operator and you'd like to set up a hyperscale data center today, and speed to market is important, and typically it's because you're using other people's money and they want their return on their money, so they're pressing on your pedal to go faster, 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 and you say, I can't find any sites that have power ready in the quantities that we need. I'm going to have to keep looking. It doesn't go well. And those conversations are already starting to happen. Now layer in 5G. 5G infrastructure isn't quite as ubiquitous and robust as they promised us it would be by this point in time, but it is coming. And when 5G really is dominant in most urban areas, which is where 60% of the population lives across America, we're going to generate 10 to 100 times more data than we're already generating. And as I explained earlier this morning, we're generating more than we know what to do with already. Mm. And so those hyperscale data centers, which is a place to process and store that data, become essential. And we have a gross shortage of those. That alone isn't causing the shortage of power, but it's a big contributor to it. E-commerce, 24/7, 365 fulfillment and return processing, big contributor. Social media, huge contributor. Electrification of everything, yeah, big contributor. So think of the demand I just rattled off, and it takes 4 years to meet the supply.
So now what I want to do is move into the questions from our audience. Sure. And this could steer us into a number of different directions, so you're just going to have to ride the wave of it. The first one was, how will affordable housing change in the future with all the technologies in place?
It's a really important question and a very good question, so whoever asked that, thank you for asking it. There are some technologies that can be brought to bear there. One is 3D printing. One is modularity. One is new materials that are more carbon friendly. Concrete is probably the least carbon friendly material known to man. It takes a lot to make it. It takes a lot to transport it. It absorbs it and it lasts forever. It's really carbon unfriendly. So could we use a different structural compound or component in that affordable housing that not only addresses the affordability and the locational aspects of it, but also contributes to the move towards decarbonization and climate change? I think it's rapidly rising. Most urban agendas, most political agendas needs to. I can report, having been to China a bunch of times, they actually build temporary dorms on the same property as the plant that the workers work at, and they're obliged to do that by the Chinese government because they bring in thousands and thousands and thousands of workers from outside that urban area to pay them a wage that, of course, we wouldn't be able to get away with paying them here in the United States or in most industrialized countries. But there may be a model in that, right, which is dorming workers for a period of time. And even if it's not on site and you transport them back and forth and put something up nearby, that might be part of the answer. But I think most of it will come when 3D printing hits commercial scale and drives down price and modularity. And we're working with some people now on three fronts. Decarbonized concrete. We're working with a company to set up a number of plants around the country that we're kind of excited about. They have sort of a new recipe, and they're very cognizant of transport distance and the emitting of carbon, and they've got a more complete delivery system. So I think it's an interesting space to watch. I know they have competitors that are trying to do the same thing, the 3D printing space. And then on the modularity, we see a number of people setting up plants that can achieve commercial scale in the next couple of years. At that point, the solutions will be more manageable. Then it becomes about policy and policymakers and taking a piece of land in the third ward or wherever it is, and making sure that affordability is in place to meet the demand for the knowledge worker moving forward. It's really an important question.
Yeah. Okay, next one is, given the increased role of automation and AI, as we talked about, where do you see people fitting in? Where are the jobs for the high school graduates?
There's all kinds of I used to have a slide that addressed sort of the jobs of the future. UX designer. That's a user experience designer, right? Everything's going to be experiential, but who's going to design the experience for us? Air traffic controller, but not for airplanes, for drones and air taxis. Okay, that's in demand. That's in short supply. You're still going to need your politicians. You're still going to need your government workers on some level. I'm not a gloom and doomer with robots taking most of our jobs. They will take the dangerous and redundant commoditized jobs, because repetition really is what they're good at, programming that repetition. I think those in a sales and service position might have to learn some new skills about what they're selling and what they're servicing, but they're going to have jobs. I think even if robots get built on a scale that might at first seem scary, guess what? They're going to be built in a factory, and somebody still has to build the factory, right? Until they can dematerialize stuff, like in Star Trek. Remember how they used to beam particles?
Yes, of course.
Right? I love that show. Way back in the day. Until they figure out how to do that, which, of course, the laws of physics say you can't. So not anytime soon. We're going to have warehouses, and we're going to have delivery trucks. Even if they're automated and without people, we're still going to be making those things with people. So I do think it's not nearly as gloom and doom as people think, but I do, you know, think lifelong learning and upskilling are concepts that people need to get comfortable with. They're going to have to learn a little bit of new stuff in order to thrive and even profiteer. And like I said earlier today, there's no issue in my mind with serving humanity and making a buck doing it, right? There's nothing wrong with that. And I think there's plenty of opportunity for people.
I have another question, a question that gets to the blockchain crypto topic we mentioned earlier. It said, with FTX's implosion, how do you see blockchain crypto tokens gaining enough corporate confidence to be the way of the future?
It's going to take a while. I actually got this question from a couple of our audience members as I was leaving the auditorium. There needs to be some amount of guardrails and guidelines for the accredited investor, because the accredited investor just got destroyed and they're not happy about it, which means the corporations, who are more conservative by definition, aren't going to go there anytime soon. But I liken it to sort of, do you remember .com 2000, the bubble burst, and everybody said, oh, thank God that's over. That was the dumbest thing ever. And out of that came Google and Amazon and Apple. Right? All those things came out of that. I expect the exact same thing to happen here with blockchain as the underpinning to crypto and to different digital currencies. I do know the United States government is experimenting with Fedcoin, right? Think of the money they lose printing paper bills and minting coins, okay? They cost more to make those than the value of the coins or the dollars themselves, okay? If they could go digital and it could be fungible around the world, if you could go to London or China or Israel and spend it, you're onto something, aren't you? Right? All you need is your digital wallet and a verification of your identity, right? And it just shows up on your credit card bill digitally. We are sort of headed to that system. How long? Again, hard to say. I don't think confidence in the corporations will come quickly or easily.
So another blockchain question which is asked, have we seen any register of deeds in the United States, or globally for that matter, looking to switch to blockchain? It seems like one of the most obvious applications.
It is.
overhauling or potentially eliminating title companies in their current form?
All right. Well, first of all, title companies aren't going anywhere because they have all the data and they know how to monetize it, but they might not be called title companies in the future. So they may change their name, but they're going to play, and they're going to play big. And they're already really transitioning, and they understand the power of data. And we've given it to them for free for all these years. So we've empowered that. I do think people should do a little bit of, you know, free time, Google search. Sometimes you end up going down a rabbit hole. More often than not, you don't. Cook County did an experiment with recording titles, deeds, on blockchain. I'm going to say it was before COVID, so 3, 4, 5 years ago. It was pretty widespread trial. They determined that it was simply not ready for prime time because all the connectivity to all the people that touch it outside of Cook County weren't ready. But once they're ready, it would work extraordinarily well. That's, you know, if you go right to the conclusion, they said it's a failure, but it's a success. This is the way of the future. We're just not ready yet because all the stakeholders aren't ready. But when the stakeholders get on board, by far, voting is another issue, right? I mean, that's a real-time, current issue, right?
Yeah.
I don't want to bring the politics into it. I just want to say that blockchain could secure a vote, authenticate it, and make it permanent in real time. It would solve everything. We don't even need voting machines. We just need a blockchain system. The world isn't ready for it, okay? But it's coming. That's one. Pay your taxes that way. Mm-hmm. Same thing.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's a matter of convincing people it is secure.
It's, you know, this is only a little bit off topic, which is 3D printing, right? So they can now 3D print proteins. They can 3D print food, okay? And in fact, I am told there's a restaurant in London where 100% of what's in that restaurant, from the food to the plates to the chairs to the tables, all 3D printed.
Really?
It's an experience, right? Yeah. I don't know how good it tastes. I'd like to go there. There will become a point in time when 3D printed food is what everybody eats because it's yummy and we like it. But it's hard to believe that today.
Yeah.
And I think it's sort of the same kind of thing. It's a gradual thing that will become mainstream over time.
Interesting. Now, I have a question more on the energy side of the
your love remarks energy
today. Lithium mines are owned by foreign governments. How are we going to grow domestic renewable energy when we don't produce our own battery storage while simultaneously weakening our currency because the world will start investing in technology that eliminates the petrodollar and these foreign governments will no longer have a need to buy the dollar?
So somebody did their homework with that question.
Okay.
They're right, though. They're spot on. These are real issues that remain to be solved. I'm not crazy about China owning all our T-bills, right? They own all of our debt. It's a problem for us moving forward. We haven't addressed that either, right?
Yeah.
But lithium's a real issue based on where it naturally occurs in his mind and who controls it. And there isn't enough lithium to make lithium-ion batteries for the electrification of everything. So really what will happen, in my opinion, is a leapfrog technology or a pivot away from lithium-ion to other sources of electrical conducting materials that do so with efficiency. It's hard to say what that will be. Some people think it's graphene, but they haven't solved that yet either. But they're working on it. There's a sodium or salt-based system that they're working on that could be promising. Could be hydrogen, has some promise, right? So I'm not convinced it's all about lithium. But for a while it is, and we are vulnerable there. That is, and it is one of the places China's cleaning our clocks already. And we're busy arguing about other stuff.
I have another energy question. Simply asked, with supply of power as an issue, why is nuclear not part of the discussion? Do you have any thoughts there?
Yes, because it's expensive, it's political, and it's dangerous. And yet, I'm a proponent. On a price per pound basis, it's very compelling. But when was the last time anybody in America built a nuclear plant?
I don't know. I can't remember.
I'd like to know what the statistic is in that. I feel like I should know it. I'll bet it's 20, 30 years. Yeah. I bet it's been a generation or two since one was built. It's really, unfortunately, so many things have been, you know, politically weaponized in the current environment. And so much depends on who's making policy and you know, do they have control and can they fund it? And it should be interesting because I do think it beats the crap out of coal, it beats the crap out of timber in terms of carbon emissions, right? And it could be part of a much bigger, broader solution, but you'd almost have to reinvent that industry from the ground up and commit probably trillions of dollars to it over 20, 30, 40 years to bring it to where it would need to be viable. It could happen. I don't know. It's a good question.
So now switching back to currency, how do you see a potential central bank digital currency affecting the commercial real estate market?
Say it again, a digital bank central currency?
How do you see a potential central bank digital currency affecting the commercial real estate market?
The whole point of blockchain is to get rid of the central bank.
Okay.
Try telling that to JP Morgan or Mr. Wells Fargo, right? You know, Mr. Bank of America. It's not like they're going to go, oh, I guess we should close up shop. So they're going to have a say in this. But it's the decentralization and the distribution, the distributed ledger nature of it, that should help avoid any sort of central authority controlling that. I think it probably mostly manifests itself as a funding mechanism for real estate, and I think people will start small. For instance, they may set aside 5 or 10% of the total cap stack of a project and experiment with either crowdfunding or tokenization, and they're not the same, but they do intersect or overlap. And if it's successful, maybe the next time it's 20% and the next time it's 50, and you know, after 4, 5, or 10 of these, they're comfortable tokenizing their real estate. There has to be a secondary market for it, right? If I buy a token and I decide it's time to sell the token, who's buying it for me and what's the value? Right, so we're a little bit away from that secondary market, right? That CMBS apparatus, if you will. Would you do that on a crowdsourcing site? Is it just bid ask, or do you set a floor and a ceiling? There's just too many things to work out before this can hit scale. Before Heinz or a CRG, or somebody like us, and there's so many others who could fit into that sentence. Might try it. We've had brokers ask us to pay them in Bitcoin, their commissions. We haven't yet. We haven't ruled it out. But right now, nobody wants it because you know, the value is less than they would have gotten otherwise. In the past, it was, I'll pay you the equivalent of that day, and you'll speculate from there on whether it goes up or down. But there's a whole lot of spouses and with kids saying, hey, that wasn't the smartest move for our family. So even that's not a perfect thing, but it's going to infiltrate the real estate space for sure over time.
Next question is, what are some of the potential negative consequences to the commercial real estate industry from the ESG movement?
Negative consequences? That's an interesting question because I'm a big believer in the ESG movement. I think the learning curve is the biggest issue on the front end. This is new material for all of us. I have a group of folks that we meet twice a year in a sort of an e-commerce forum. It's my friendly competitors and other members of the real estate ecosystem. And we just had a meeting in Chicago in October. And we all realized that just since we had last met in April, we all had launched an ESG project. Every one of our companies, big companies. And we decided to collaborate rather than, hey, let's all learn it on our own and keep it a secret. Let's collaborate and see if we can't get to a best practice. So I think there's that, but I don't know that that's a pain. I view it more as an opportunity, but the learning curve can be painful, right? Change is great. You go first. You know, it's sort of one of those. But at the end of the day, if you can decarbonize and deliver to the market a functional operating property that people want to be at and be a part of, I think it's wonderful. I think it's a tremendous upside opportunity for everybody. If you're going to mandate anything, that's what I would be mandating, right? But again, as I said earlier today, mandates, personally, I don't believe mandates work. You say you have to, I don't want to. Just human nature. But I'm not sure there's a ton of downside in that.
more specific real estate question, and you talked about today seeing spec development really slow down or dry up. Someone asked, do you think speculative industrial development will still occur but only on a smaller scale or not at all for a while? Most business in leased space don't get in front of their space needs with enough time to build something in time. I think it was most businesses in leased space.
Yeah, I think that's right.
Don't get in front of their space needs with enough time.
Yeah, to build something and in time. That's exactly where the speculative market worked so well for so long, right? Was the timing. Because most businesses wait till the last minute to pull the trigger on that, and they really don't want to go through a whole design build process and then manage it, even hire somebody to manage it. So I kind of concur with the question. Here's what I would predict. While the underwriting has become blurry, almost impossible, and lenders have retreated to the sidelines, no matter what they say, they're not offering viable terms, quantities, amounts, percentages, guarantees, even if they're still making offers to provide debt. So in effect, there's no debt. As long as there's no debt to match up with the equity, you have two choices. You have cash or sidelines, okay? Cash isn't a bad way to go if you're convinced you can put some leverage on it, some debt on it at a later point in time. And you probably will be able to at some amount of interest rate. Who's to say what that will be, up or down? But cash buyers typically want a discount. They don't want to pay retail. And there hasn't been a trenching of price on land or buildings enough yet to where those cash buyers are anything but a one-off right now. So what's going to happen is the current crop of spec buildings that was funded before the commercial or the capital markets changed will finish. The demand will absorb them. We will then go through a 2023 and 2024 without much, if any, spec building coming behind that. Which means the users that come to market in that period of time will either have to build a suit or absorb a second generation building. And they're going to have to pay more rent. Rates are going to go up because of this, not down. Okay? With rates continuing to go up, as interest rates stabilize, as inflation stabilizes, as lenders come back to the table, you'll have a new wave of speculative construction that will start, will fund maybe end of 23, early 24, will deliver in 25, because with the supply chain, it's taken 12 to 18 months from inception to delivery, even for just a basic industrial building, especially one of size. There's going to be that void for 18 months, a year, 2 years, somewhere in there, where rates are really going to go up, because I think demand will be steady. It may not go up, but I don't think it's going down a lot. And if demand is steady, that's going to cause rates to rise, which is going to bolster the case to build new spec. Vacancy rates are already low, will stay low as that absorption occurs. So I expect spec to come roaring back when capital markets allow for it. They want it, by the way. They want to lend money. They just don't know how to underwrite, and they don't want to be in the job market and be wrong.
Yeah.
By underwriting something today that, you know, comps from last week don't mean anything next week, which is the first time we can remember that really happening. It's a data point, but it's not the ultimate data point. Things are too dynamic. There are too many variables that are causing chaos in the market, so you can't underwrite right now. The minute you have a certain amount of stabilization, underwriting will return, lending will return, spec building will return, but there will be a gap.
Now, on another topic, you touched on climate change this morning, and so I had a question where someone was commenting saying climate change is the existential issue of the human race. Milwaukee could be a primary beneficiary, which is something you mentioned.
The entire Upper Great Lakes area, I think, is a net winner in all that.
Yeah. So the question is sort of where does this go, but the question also had a comment that expressed that they felt blockchain will make it worse. So your thoughts on climate change impact, as you mentioned, to the upper Midwest and Milwaukee, and is blockchain a factor? Does blockchain contribute to climate change, as this questioner feels?
Well, listen, I think blockchain is going to find its way into everything, and that would include climate change, but who are the stakeholders, right? It's not the blockchain, it's blockchains plural, shared by stakeholders and only by those stakeholders. So in the question, who are the stakeholders in the Upper Great Lakes or in Milwaukee when it comes to climate change? Is it the government? Is it businesses? Is it, you know, who are those stakeholders? They may choose to use blockchain as a means to automate or accelerate the functionality of what they're trying to accomplish. Think about smart contracts for a minute. If this happens, then that happens. That's a blockchain application. It's a smart contract. If this shipment arrives, if we achieve carbon reduction of X, then payment is automatically made to party Y. Okay? So I think it actually is a net positive. I don't know that there's negativity to it. I think there's a lot of fear of the unknown, and that's reasonable.
Are they thinking of energy usage for crypto or something?
Oh, it could be. I hadn't thought of that, but you're right. I mean, you know, Bitcoin mining, crypto mining is an enormous energy hog. At my energy company, we like it because they make good customers for us, right? We procure energy for them. But that aside, could that be bad? Unless there's an ability to meet the demand. That's a big demand. It's a big draw, right? Maybe in that context, it could be a challenge, because shouldn't that power go to the hospital first and to the school where we send our kids first and to the airport and to the government buildings? And, you know, there's just a much higher pecking order in my mind than the crypto data mining application for it, especially if what we've talked about today, which is the pure supply of it, is in short supply. We could do a hydro model here, like in the Pacific Northwest. We've got, right, Lake Michigan is a key asset. Our energy rates here are very low compared to the coasts on a kilowatt hour basis. We'll continue to be lower, relatively speaking, than other places. And that will attract large consumers of electricity to this region. How we service them with power, could it be nuclear, you know, remains to be seen. Where is it bad? If we burn coal and we, you know, emit carbon into the atmosphere, we will not have future generations. I mean, the thing about climate change, and I didn't really say this well today, I don't think, is that it's existential. And for that reason, it kind of trumps everything else that we talk about. We have to be here on Earth to enjoy the things and benefit from the things that we've been, you know, talking about and expecting to occur in the next 10 or 20 or 30 years. If we don't do something about climate change and the average temperature on Earth goes up 1.5 degrees or 2 degrees or 2.5 degrees, it's not a pretty picture about what happens on Earth. And that's, you know, in our lifetimes, if we're not careful about it. So I'm all about figuring out energy solutions that can meet all the demand, but that are carbon neutral or carbon friendly.
And so looking at it from the perspective of the Midwest and Milwaukee, you know, you talk about the existential threat, but you also talk about how we stand to be a gainer in the climate change picture, because problems elsewhere will have people might not flee our winters anymore. They might actually be coming here for them.
You know, there's quality of life, there's affordability, there's central, being in the center of the country. So easier to get where you need to go from Milwaukee or from Chicago. There's the fresh water supply, and don't underestimate how important that really is.
Yeah.
Ask the people in Las Vegas or Phoenix or San Diego about that. That's a really big deal, right? Lake Powell is effectively gone, right? I mean, so it's a really, really, really big deal. I think if we marketed it ourselves a little bit more proactively and a little more aggressively, and there's no shame, in my opinion, to add a marketing element to it, right? I don't know what that would be, the safe space, the future-proof yourself in Milwaukee or in the Great Lakes. But there's a campaign probably in there somewhere.
So my last audience question said, as we become more dependent on technology, as Jeffrey believes, can we stay ahead of hackers and others? You talked about hackers today. Can we stay ahead of hackers and others, including foreign government intervention, that want to disrupt our economy?
I, as I sit here today, cannot guarantee it. I don't think anybody could sit here and guarantee it. We're pretty good at prevention, but there have been some noticeable events of ransomware. There's been occasions where power plants have been temporarily taken over, where the grid has been turned off. There is that capability, and it could be chaotic. We have to trust that the people we've empowered to protect us are doing their jobs. It's up to us to be educated enough to be sure, A, we're electing the right people and funding the right initiatives to be sure that's the case. By the way, I think blockchain, which is taking data and distributing it across a million computers, which makes it, in theory, unhackable. The minute somebody says unhackable, I go, oh, somebody can hack that. Mm-hmm. You know, so I'm not even promising that's unhackable, but that's the whole point, right? Is it's untraceable and unhackable, right? And so if you operated your power plant, your nuclear power plant, or your cloud internet off of a blockchain platform, in theory, you should have a higher level of insulation. Then there's system redundancy, the backup, and then there's the backup to the backup, right? Those are all real things. We know what to do. We know how to do it. Right now, I'd say we're probably losing that cyber security battle, but it's very early stages, and it's the right question to ask, but it remains to be seen whether we could ever get ahead of it and stay ahead of it.
Yeah. Well, you've covered a lot of ground, Jeffrey, between your keynote address at our commercial real estate conference and here in the podcast, so I just want to say a big thank you to you for participating both in the event and here on the podcast today, and you've given us absolutely a lot to think about going forward, so thank you so much for being part of this.
And thank you again for having me. I've actually had a lot of fun. I love your event. Really was good energy, a lot of people. 20 years of it, you should be very proud of that, and thanks for making me a part of it.
Absolutely. All right, well, that'll do it today for the BizTimes MKE podcast.
This is Dan Meyer with BizTimes Media. You've been listening to the BizTimes MKE podcast. For more business news and insights, be sure to go to biztimes.com and subscribe to any of our daily e-newsletters and our magazine, BizTimes Milwaukee.